This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges joins us to talk about his new book, Unspeakable, concerning the most taboo topics in America today.
We'll talk with New York Times bestselling author Catherine Pellinero about her recent book, Absolute Madness.
This is the true story of a white man who serially killed 16 black men in the investigation and prosecution and the failure of the criminal justice system and the mental health system to stop this.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The year 2017 has seen a qualitative acceleration and consolidation of power by the forces on the right, which have been accurately described as a form of fascism. Three significant books were published this year addressing this phenomena, where it came from and how to fight it. We have interviewed Nancy McLean on her book, Democracy in Chains, about the origins and organization of the billionaire forces like the Koch brothers who have orchestrated the takeover of 25 state legislatures and who are attacking every institution of what is left of American democracy. We interviewed John Bellamy Foster on his book, Trump in the White House, about who supports the Trump agenda and why. Today, we speak with returning guest Chris Hedges about his book, Unspeakable, which consists of talks with David Talbot about the most forbidden topics in America. Chris Hedges worked for the New York Times as a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for 20 years before he quit. He was active in the Occupy movement, writes a weekly column for Truthdig, and is the author of American Fascism, The Christian Right, and The War on America, among many other notable books. He teaches college courses through Rutgers University to students in the New Jersey prison system and helped his students write a play about mass incarceration called Caged that will have its premiere this spring at the Passage Theater in Trenton, New Jersey. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Fittingly, Chris, you're our last guest on Law and Disorder for the year, and I'd like to talk to you about what you might call a political and moral balance sheet of 2017. Barack Obama left office in January, and now we've got Trump and the forces he reflects and whose interests he advances. You wrote in your book, Unspeakable, that the liberals paved the way for him. You sued Obama in federal courts to block Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which overturned the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act. What was at stake in your lawsuit, and how did it turn out?
Well, let's begin with Obama. So Obama follows in this tradition set by Bill Clinton, whereby all of the traditional causes that the old Democratic Party was at least willing to, I wouldn't always say fight for, but to consider labor, immigrant rights, the rights of African Americans. Clinton abandoned all of these. He continued to use the language of liberalism, that feel your pain language of liberalism, but he betrayed those core constituencies within the Democratic Party, beginning in 1994 with NAFTA, probably the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act, which makes it very difficult for workers to organize, the omnibus crime bill that he pushed through with Biden that massively increased the length of sentences, three strikes, you're out, laws, you know, long, even life convictions for nonviolent crimes, swelling the prison population from about 700,000 to 2 million. It's now about 2.2 or 2.3. Militarizing police departments, destroying welfare, deregulating the FCC. We're watching the ramifications of that as we speak, the negative ramifications of that, and, of course, Glass-Steagall. So he catered to corporate interests, and he knew what he was doing. He got corporate money. So by the 90s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity in terms of corporate money with the Republicans. And actually, when Obama ran in 2008, he got more. So Obama continued this trajectory of self-identifying as a liberal. Even there's that famous moment when he chastises Cornel West because he says he's a progressive. This is, of course, utterly absurd, especially when you bring in figures like Larry Summers into your cabinet. Geithner, Holder, who's another stooge of Wall Street. And Obama, in some ways, you had complete continuity in terms of serving the interests of the 1% from Clinton to George W. Bush to Obama. Obama's assault on civil liberties, as you well know, was worse than those carried out by George W. Bush. And you mentioned my lawsuit when I sued Obama over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act in federal court in the Southern District Court of New York. This overturned the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, as you said, which prohibits the military from carrying out domestic policing. It essentially, at its core, allows the U.S. government to seize U.S. citizens who substantially support, that's a nebulous legal term, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or something called, and I'm quoting, associated forces, whatever that is, strip them of due process and hold them in military facilities, including our offshore black sites, indefinitely, or in the language of Section 1021, until the end of hostilities, which in an age of permanent war is forever. So we went to trial, and the judge, Catherine B. Forrest, ruled that this was in violation of the law, of the 1878 Posse Comitatus, which it clearly is. It was interesting. It got very little press coverage, especially by the so-called liberal or left media like MSNBC, because, of course, all they did was work as a PR firm for the Obama White House. The most journalistically credible coverage actually came from my old employer, the New York Times, which covered the trial. And then when Judge Forrest ruled, wrote an editorial praising her judicial decision. And in her opinion, she wrote that this opens the way for the government to criminalize an entire segment of the population. And she brought up the case of the 110,000 Japanese-Americans who were interned in camps in World War II, and essentially strip them of all rights. I mean, carry out acts of extraordinary rendition on the streets of American cities and disappear them because they don't have access to a lawyer once they're seized. This was Obama. Obama, I think most legal scholars would say, grossly misinterpreted the 2002 Authorization to Use Military Force Act as giving the U.S. government the right to assassinate American citizens, as we saw with Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen and, of course, his 16-year-old son. It was Obama who misused the Espionage Act, which is the equivalent of our kind of Foreign Secrets Act, to shut down whistleblowers. And as James Risen and other from the New York Times will tell you, it essentially killed the possibility of any kind of serious investigative journalism into the machinery of government itself, which was its intent. So what we saw was the betrayal of that constituency with deeply hypocritical language about continuing to care about that constituency. Obama, I think, was in many ways our last chance to deal seriously with climate change, with social inequality, which is now going to be turbocharged with this tax bill. So we saw revolt. We saw a revolt in the Democratic Party with Bernie Sanders, the Democratic machine, of course, ensuring that he did not get the nomination, and a revolt with Trump. But I argue, I have a show on RT, so I'm kind of caught up in this demonization of Russia, this witch hunt, which, of course, the elites don't want to address the fundamental issue, that it was their betrayal of the working class in particular that gave rise to these insurgencies and led to the election of this very frightening, buffoonish, but very frightening and dangerous figure who now occupies the presidency and is rapidly dismantling our very anemic, already very anemic system by which we can protect ourselves from the worst exploitation and predatory abuses of the corporate state.
You didn't support Bernie Sanders, but you do believe that he did a few good things. Like what?
I the night before the climate march in New York, where I spoke with Bernie and Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein and Shama Sawant. Shama and I raised the issue of Bernie running as an independent, and we were both very clear that we would support him if he ran as an independent. Although I have to throw in this caveat, Bernie Sanders just will not take on the military-industrial complex or empire. At its most kind of basic level, you can't be a socialist unless you are an anti-imperialist. However, he has throughout his life with consistency addressed issues of social inequality and the programs that have made war on the working and increasingly the middle class. But his decision to run as a Democrat, in my view, and I think the facts bore that out, was a huge mistake. I never believed the Democratic Party would allow him to gain the nomination, which is what happened, and there were all sorts of dirty tricks they used, not just all the dark money, $1 billion I think Clinton raised, but banning independents from voting in the primaries, although I should say taxpayers pay for the logistical carrying out of the primaries, stealing the Nevada caucus, superdelegates. I mean, they gamed the system, not to mention, of course, we now know that the DNC, not surprisingly, was part of the Clinton machine. So, and my fear at the time and Shama's fear was that there would be all this enthusiasm, all this energy, and all this money, and he raised significant money, and small contributions mostly, would in the end be squandered with him running around telling us to vote for Hillary Clinton. That we had to build a movement, a third-party movement, a resistance movement that extended beyond an electoral cycle. And Bernie's answer was, I don't want to end up like Ralph Nader. And I admire Ralph. I was a speechwriter. And he was right. The Democratic Party would have destroyed him. That assessment was correct. They have a quid pro quo with him where they don't run a serious candidate against him in his Senate races in Vermont, and he works to stymie third-party movements in Vermont. So he's right, but for me that was an act of political cowardice. He would have lost his seniority, and now we're watching him try and mount a campaign to run again, but my position remains the same.
You know, you supported Jill Stein, as I did. She was a guest on our show, and she offered Bernie Sanders her spot on the Green Party ticket, and my thought was, had he taken it, I think he missed his historic opportunity, but had he taken it and had he organized a viable movement, even if he would have lost the presidency, there would have been a movement there to put a break on what these Trump and billionaires behind him are doing. And we don't have that instrument now.
That's exactly right. And, you know, this was always Ralph's argument. Nobody understands corporate power or has been fighting it longer or with more integrity than Ralph Nader. And Ralph said, you know, this was back in 2000, we have to get 5, 10, 15 million people who are willing to step outside the Democratic Party establishment so that we can pressure the Democratic Party to counter this assault, this kind of assault that they're carrying out on behalf of the 1%, the corporate oligarchs. You're right, he wouldn't have won, but it would have created that pressure. That's number one. Number two, it takes a long time to build an alternative political movement. Parties like Syriza a decade ago in Greece were polling at about 4%, which is slightly higher than what the Green Party gets. But it's not going to happen within an election cycle. And we desperately, I don't know, we can speak about this later. I mean, the situation now has deteriorated to such an extent. I don't know how much resistance politically within the political system we're going to be able to mount. But yeah, for all of those reasons, not that he cared or anyone cared. I didn't endorse him. I did, you know, in the primaries, certainly vote for him in New Jersey.
Do you believe that an insurgency can take back the Democratic Party? You know, what's the alternative?
No, because the leadership of the Democratic Party is a creation of the oligarchic elite, figures like Schumer, Pelosi, the Clintons, I mean, we would have to begin with campaign finance, i.e., these large corporate entities cannot fund our system of legalized bribery. These people would disappear as political figures. The Democratic Party doesn't function as a political party like the Labor Party, which had mechanisms within it to, of course, the shock of the traditional Labor Party leadership that allowed the rise of Corbyn. We don't. There is no party. It's kind of the base doesn't matter. The base is mobilized. There's a kind of hyperventilating media. But if you talk about a political party as actually expressing the will and the desires of the base, the Democratic Party is not a party in the way, you know, parliamentary parties are in Britain or in other parts of Europe.
Chris, do you think we have any institutions left yet that can authentically be called democratic if we define democracy to mean the expression of popular will?
No, not any. And that is the assessment of our most important political philosopher, Sheldon Wolin, who died recently. I recommend his book, Democracy Incorporated, to everyone. Like all great thinkers, Wolin helped give me the vocabulary to understand the reality around us, in particular the political reality. He describes our system as one of what he calls inverted totalitarianism, and by that he means it's not a classical totalitarian system whereby you have a charismatic or led by a charismatic or demagogic figure, but you've undergone what John Ralston Saul calls this corporate coup d'etat, where you have the facade, like the old Roman Republic, of the Constitution, electoral politics, the iconography and language of American patriotism. But internally, corporations have seized all of the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. And I think that's right. I think that's where we are. And that's why I've been a strong supporter of movements. Standing Rock, I went to Standing Rock. I was, of course, very supportive of the Occupy movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement against Israel. I think we've got to pit power against power now. And the only power we have is to build alternative institutions and powerful movements that carry out sustained acts of civil disobedience.
We forgot to mention Occupy. And this is not a well-known fact, I think. Occupy was shut down by a coordinated attack by the Obama administration.
Yeah, completely.
That was one of the reasons you list in your book, Unspeakable, for why you dislike liberals so deeply.
Yeah, I learned to dislike liberals when I went to Harvard Divinity School, but I lived in the housing projects in Roxbury and commuted every day into Cambridge, where my classmates would sit around talking about empowering people they never met. That kind of cured me on the liberal class.
I went to NYU Law School, where my classmates would sit there and get their shoes shined reading the Wall Street Journal out in the front stoops.
Right. Yeah.
A chapter in Unspeakable is titled Revolution or Fascism. What do we have to do politically, given that alternative?
Well, I mean, Trump is the logical conclusion to a decayed democracy, in the same way that Slobodan Milosevic — I covered Yugoslavia for the New York Times — Slobodan Milosevic or Radovan Karadzic were the logical conclusion to the collapse of a kind of attempt within the 1990s to create, or 1980s, excuse me, to create a kind of functioning democracy within Yugoslavia, as was the rise of the Nazis' response to the collapse of the Weimar Republic, but particularly after the 1929 crash, when the socialist government under Ebert attempted to impose austerity, which was the response of the Democratic Party, imposing programs of austerity, which of course makes things worse. And so the rise of a figure like Trump essentially signals, as it does at the end of any dying empire, the seizure of power by the kleptocrats. Now, Trump, of course, personally is a kleptocrat, and we see it with the tax bill. I think he and his heirs stand to gain $1 billion a year just on this bill or something. But more importantly, the kleptocracies carried out by the big banks, by the fossil fuel industry that just seized 2 million acres of land in Utah, there's no restraint. There are no internal or external restraints. And these people know only one word, and that's more. So appealing to the system to carry out acts of reform, which is what they want us to do. They want us to write petitions or call our congressmen's or congresswoman's office.
Donate a dollar.
Send a dollar or, you know, to moveon.org. There's an organization nobody should give money to. Build grassroots campaigns and be part of the Bernie revolution, whatever he's going to call it now. And this is just, you know, if we haven't learned by now, an utter and complete waste of energy and time. But if you step outside the system, I think we saw it with Standing Rock. So there you had nonviolent water protectors led by our indigenous leaders. And the response of the state, this is under Obama, was fierce. Rubber bullets, over 700 people arrested. Water cannons laced with pepper spray and sub-freezing temperatures. Attack dogs, constant surveillance, drones. When I went there in November, you had private contractors. They didn't even have any distinguishing. They weren't law enforcement. They had kind of quasi-military uniforms, but you didn't know who they were, carrying long-barreled weapons, blocking these back roads. I mean, I had to go all the way around up north, it took us hours to get in, stopping our vehicles and sending us back. And, of course, it is going to be even worse under Trump for any kind of resistance. Because essentially we're at a moment in American history where the ruling ideology, neoliberalism, globalization, unfettered capitalism, whatever you want to call it, is bankrupt. Nobody's buying it, on the left or the right. Nobody's buying this ideology. And there is no counterargument. They have no counterargument now to those of us who are critics. And so where before we had been marginalized, shut out of the mainstream media, now we have to be shut down. And that's the process we're watching. So you see the imposition by Google, Facebook, these big corporations that are wedded to the national security state, the imposition of algorithms they call it impressions, but to move people away from dissident, progressive, anti-war, left-wing websites, including not only the ones I write for, but the ones that reprint my stuff. So Alternet's traffic is down by 63%. World Socialist website is down by 80%. Truthdig, where I write a column every Monday, is down by 20%. That, coupled with the destruction of net neutrality, essentially gives the state the ability to impose a very frightening form of censorship. And that's what's coming next, because suddenly those of us, those who are anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist critics, become dangerous because the ideology that has justified this pillage no longer has any credibility. You know who writes about this is Alexander Berkman in an essay. I can't remember the name of it, but he writes this essay that says that when the ruling elite's credibility is destroyed, whether it's the monarchy or anything else, then all they have left is the iron fist. That's it. And ideology, as Gramsci understood, propaganda, ideology, are powerful tools of control. But they don't have those tools. That's another issue. But the whole demonization of Russia, the ability to attack people such as myself, and this, of course, these algorithms are imposed by Google because of supposedly fake news. And this is what, despotisms always do. They attempt to paint us as in service of a foreign power, traitors. And this is, of course, what they're doing to Jill Stein, the Green Party, right now.
They're trying to hook her up with the whole Russian BS story. Chris, let's talk about how the pillars of power are undermined. You say it's a subterranean, unseen process. Tariq Ali, socialist writer who you and I admire, once wrote for a British newspaper called The Red Mole. You write about a tipping point. Is there a process of like a mole burrowing going on now? And what would be the tipping point? What would that look like?
Well, that is the process, and the elites know it, and that's why they're so frightened. you never know what the tipping point is. I covered all revolutions, the revolutions in Eastern Europe, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania. I covered both of the two Palestinian uprisings or intifadas. I covered the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic. And what the tipping point is usually banal. You know, it's like the vendor in Tunisia who lights himself on. You can never predict it. I mean, the first intifada was caused by a car accident. It was a van full of Palestinian day workers hit by an Israeli truck, seven of them were killed. So as a reporter, we always knew the tinder was there, but none of us knew what could ignite it. And that's always true. I mean, 6 weeks before the Russian Revolution, Lenin's giving a talk in Switzerland saying, you know, those of us who are old may never see the revolution. I was in Leipzig covering the fall of the communist dictatorship in East Germany. And it was the afternoon of November 9th. That's the day the wall came down. I mean, people figuratively. I'm with the leaders of the opposition. They're saying, well, maybe within a year there'll be free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. Within a few hours, the Berlin Wall, as an impediment to human traffic, did not exist. So this was also true when I covered the street demonstrations that brought down Milosevic. I was with Djindjic, who was later assassinated, and Draskovic, and all these figures. It was fascinating because they were just scrambling to read the zeitgeist of the crowds. That's all they did. They weren't leading it. And in fact, in revolutionary movements, that is the most important quality. So it's there. The tinder is there. Now, we should be clear that that doesn't mean that we're going to have a revolution. We may have a revolution, but it may be right wing. I mean, unfortunately, because the left is so anemic, labor unions are destroyed. I mean, all of the mechanisms by which working men and women had to pit power against power in this long, century-long assault in the name of anti-communism, the hollowing out of liberal institutions, the collapse of the press, which is in complete collusion with Trump. They love his reality show. It makes them a lot of money. CNN made more money last year than they've ever made. They'll make more money this year. You know, they've long ago walked away from the business of journalism or news, so most of the country remains utterly invisible, so we can listen to these hyper-ventilating, overpaid pundits talk about tweets that, you know, Coker is sending to Trump and Trump's. I mean, something's going to happen, but it may be the kind of social upheaval that leads to a much more recognizable form of American fascism, which will be colored by the Christian right. I mean, the ideological vacuum, Trump has no ideology. The ideological vacuum of Trump is now rapidly being filled by the Christian right. Not only did I go to seminary, but I spent 2 years traveling around the country writing a book about the Christian right called American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War on America. And I didn't use that word lightly. These are Christian heretics that the liberal church failed in calling out. I mean, Jesus didn't come to make us rich. You don't have to spend 3 years at Harvard Divinity School as I did to figure that out. But they wouldn't fight them. And so that fusion of the symbols of religion, which was true. You know, Hitler established the Protestant German Christian Church, which had the Christian cross on one side, the Nazi flag on another. That's what the Christian right is. And I find it amusing that everyone says, well, how can they support Trump? He's so sleazy. Well, I covered all of these figures, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and Trump's got nothing on them. I mean, these guys are sleaze incorporated in terms of including sexual escapades, pillage. I mean, they prey on despair. They're all worth millions. I think Pat Robertson is worth $1 billion. I mean, Trump is, kin. I mean, they get him because they're the same. They're con artists just like him. That's what I worry about. And, you know, as Noam Chomsky, I think, correctly points out, everybody thinks it wouldn't be great if we get rid of Trump. Chomsky, and I agree, Pence is worse. At least Trump is incompetent. And Pence really represents that dominionist, frightening, proto-fascist Christianity that is, they are now the people who are filling all these federal judgeships. They're all coming out of the Federalist Society and the Christian right.
Yeah, 90 judges are going to be appointed by Trump and the people that advise him. In your book, Unspeakable, you enumerate the prerequisites for revolution from studying the historian Crane Britton. I wanted to ask you about that so that people get an idea how to evaluate our times.
that revolutions are always created. This is Davies, the other Jeffrey Davies, the also great theorist on revolution, along with Brinton. Revolutions are not created by the poor. Otherwise, there would be constant revolution, especially in countries where poverty is even more pronounced than our own. Revolution is created by those who have aspirations that they realize will never be filled. And that's clearly, you know, the idea of the collapse of the American dream. This is very much colored the Occupy movement. It was largely a white, middle-class, college-educated young movement of kids who took out tremendous amounts of money, borrowed tremendous amounts of money, got out of college, tens of thousands of dollars of debt, and there was no place for them in the economy. They're what Bakunin would call déclassé intellectuals, which Bakunin, unlike Lenin, argued were a key element to revolution. Bakunin, of course, was right. It is about the understanding that that society, you have become, in Marxian terms, redundant or surplus labor to that society. There's no place for you. This is, of course, why repression in marginal communities where mostly poor people of color live is so fierce, because it's a form of social control. The mass incarceration, the police terror, because these people have utterly been written off. And if they didn't have, and we should always throw the other form of social control in poor communities are evictions, constant evictions, so you can never create any kind of neighborhood organizations or solidarity. So every 6 months you're thrown out of, so you evict the women and children, you lock up the men, basically. Although women are now the fastest growing segment in the American prison system. So interestingly enough, you have an elite that is no longer able to credibly defend the ruling ideology. I think that that is true. Thomas Friedman keeps trying. You have a retreat of an elite within a Versailles or a Forbidden City, or in our case, I think a New Yorker writer called it Richistan. You know, these people don't ever fly commercial airlines. They live in palatial estates in Greenwich, Connecticut or somewhere. And the only people they ever see in the working class are, you know, their maids or their chauffeurs or their gardeners. And so they lose touch with reality. And I think that's true of our elites. They extract so much that they provoke a response. And that's what we're seeing. So all of these preconditions are there. And I would finally add that, like Brinton and Davies, that what usually ignites it is some kind of a crisis, usually economic. So in the case of Yugoslavia, you had serious hyperinflation at the end of the 1980s. Hyperinflation, I've lived through three of them, is very disconcerting because once your money is really worth nothing, all of the systems of power lose credibility. So that's what happened in Weimar. That's what happened in Yugoslavia. So, and we're certainly, I mean, Wall Street is back to all of its old games. It's very clear that some kind of massive economic dislocation is coming. There are many credible economists who argue that it'll be worse than 2008, but something's coming because they're just doing the same thing they did before. It's a speculative economy. They don't make anything. They just attempt to make money off of money, and part of that is imposing harsher and harsher forms of debt peonage. We see it with students who borrow money. And even if they declare bankruptcy, they still owe that money. It's still accruing interest. I mean, there's no way to get out of it. And courtesy of the U.S. Congress, their interest rates are about to go beyond what they would have gotten if they'd taken it from a commercial bank. We see it in poor communities where budgets are slashed, and they make up, for instance, in St. Louis County, 40% of that budget comes from fines. So they just have to make up fines. Fines for not mowing your lawn. They're not making that up. It's real. Fines for standing, I can't remember, more than 3 minutes on a street corner, anything to, like, rob poor people. You see it. You get stopped by the cops, and then you got to pay $340 to do an online alcoholism prevention course. And then you've got to go see a therapist to certify that you're not an alcoholic, which costs you another $150. And then you've got to pay $150 a month to pay off your DWI. Well, I mean, poor people can't pay this. And they struggle to pay it. And then they end up back in jail. I mean, so many people go to jail. I mean, that's why, I can't remember the name of the guy, who his car was stopped, his taillight was out, and he fled, and the cop shot him in the back and killed him. Well, people, why did he flee? He fled because he had outstanding warrants, which basically meant he just owed them money. And he knew he'd have to go back to jail, and he'd lose his job and everything else. So they're not going to stop. They will push and push and push until there's something happens.
An important understanding for the movement to arrive at is the understanding that we cannot be seen by the majority of people as advocates for violence. As we speak, trials have begun on 200 demonstrators from the January 20th inaugural in Washington, D.C. They are charged with serious felonies because several of the demonstrators broke windows. You took a leading role in polemicizing against the Black Bloc when they advocated these kinds of tactics. What's wrong with the Black Bloc's position on this?
And I would include some of Antifa. Antifa split on this
yes.
issue. Revolutions never work. We'll go back to the theorists of revolution, like Brinton, like Davies. Never work, and I think history bears this out, unless a significant portion of the security apparatus defects. That was true in the French Revolution. That was true in the Russian Revolution with the Cossacks. Defections within the ruling apparatus, it creates paralysis because they don't know who to trust, and they don't know who they can trust. I mean, what is it that allowed the protesters in East Germany, which was the most sophisticated security and surveillance state in human history until our own, to succeed? It was that Honecker, the communist dictator, sent down an elite paratroop division to Leipzig to fire on the crowd. And they got there, and the local communist leader said, no, you're not. Honecker was out of power in a week. What same thing with when the Cossacks defected and wouldn't crush the bread riots. In Petrograd, they rushed the Tsar back in a railway carriage because he was up at the front, you know, leading this disastrous campaign on the Eastern Front. He didn't even make it back. He had to abdicate on a railway siding. Same with the Shah. I covered Iran. You know, what happened? The Shah fled the country, and a day or two later, the head of the armed forces said, we will no longer defend this regime. It's over. So we need to create critical numbers. Any counterinsurgency campaign will tell you, and you can probably pull this stuff off online. I covered the wars in Central America. So, you know, U.S. counterinsurgency was something I saw and knew intimately. You have to demonize the movement by making people frightened of it. And that's what Black Bloc does quite effectively. So what is it that terrified the state, let's say, about Zuccotti? Where Black Bloc was not an issue. They kind of just a bunch of kids from the suburbs, usually white males, sitting around with $600 knee pads and elbow pads bitching about the General Assembly. They destroyed the Occupy movement in Oakland, which was the country's most important and powerful Occupy movement. So what is it that frightened the state? It's when the mothers and fathers came in from New Jersey and were pushing their kids in strollers up and down. So that terrified the state. And I think we who were involved often and don't understand how terrified the state was. They were truly frightened. If that movement had built and spread, which is why there was a coordinated campaign to shut it down, and that's what allowed, you know, the elites to push forward a figure like Obama as a kind of brand, as a distraction, because they were so frightened. So if we're going to succeed, we have to do what revolutionary movements have done in the past, which is bring hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, remember Podemos and all the Spanish opposition surrounding the Spanish parliament? That's the kind of stuff we've got to do. But we need a critical mass. We need huge numbers, and we need for it to be sustained. And it needs to be nonviolent because we need to speak, in essence, to not all of them are going to be able to hear, but to a segment of those within the ruling apparatus who no longer want to defend these crooks. I mean, the demeanor of blue-uniformed New York City cops in Zuccotti was very different from these white shirts who were making $110,000 a year. And even when the white shirts, the officers would come down. And if you look like the on YouTube, often the most egregious acts of physical violence were carried out by the white shirts. But the demeanor of the officers changed as soon as those white their superior officers appeared at Zuccotti. You know, we saw it with the Chicago Teachers Union strike where they were walking through the streets and they would go into precinct houses to use the bathroom and the police would applaud. That's what truly terrifies the elites. And that's what we have to do if we're going to wrest this country back from the hands, I would argue, of the most dangerous political forces in American history. Ones that are barreling us towards a kind of very frightening corporate totalitarianism.
Chris, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to conclude by asking you about our friend Lynn Stewart, who we lost this past year. You've written about her virtue, and you spoke at her memorial. She was truly a remarkable, brave, kind person. She truly led a moral life, if not necessarily a successful one in conventional terms.
The moral life's never, in conventional terms, successful. And if you lead, in conventional terms, a successful life, it's usually never moral. The point of the moral life is that it stands with the oppressed, no matter what the cost. And when you truly stand with the oppressed, as Lynn Stewart did throughout her life, as a lawyer defending poor people in Harlem, defending black radicals who were persecuted relentlessly by the state in particular. Many of them are still locked up in prison, Sundiata Akoli, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and others in the 1970s. And when you stand up as she did for Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, and I speak as the former Middle East Bureau Chief for the New York Times, he had nothing to do with the attacks on the World Trade Center. Zero.
I know that.
And she knew that. And you know, she herself finally goes to prison. In a kangaroo court orchestrated by Dick Cheney and others, this shows her magnificence as a human being. She got up and spoke about my friend Mumia, as my friend Mumia Abu-Jamal says. Mumia, the great black revolutionary incarcerated in Frackville, Pennsylvania, again railroaded in a trial with tremendous inconsistencies and faulty evidence and everything else. But I thought that, I said, wow. I mean, she's a lawyer. She knew what she was doing, but she just wouldn't betray her friends. It's not popular to be religious, but I do come out of a religious tradition, that old left tradition, which my father represented, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. He was involved in the gay rights movement. But that old Berrigan left. And it is that understanding that, you know, at least within the Christian faith, the person that you were called on to emulate as best as you can was abandoned by all his friends, turned on by the crowd, I'm talking about Jesus Christ, condemned by the authorities to death, put on death row, and executed. And so as the great, our greatest theologian, James Cone, says, faith is the inversion of the world's values. Or as Daniel Berrigan, who I got to know at the end of his life, said, for him, faith is the belief that the good draws to it the good. There may be no empirical evidence around you to prove that. In fact, everything around you may be worse. But that's what faith is. The Buddhists call it karma. But having lived as long as I have and covered, you know, I was in the Magic Lantern Theater every night with Vaclav Havel. I watched people who led moral lives, who attempted, as Lynn did, as best they could to carry out the good. That does have a power that stays with you. They're kind of invisible witnesses to your own life. And if you truly are able to feel what they feel, when your moment comes, you cannot betray them as Lynn would not betray Mumia, even as she was about to get, it was a 10-year sentence, right, in a Texas, and she had cancer.
When Amy Goodman asked her, would you do it again? She said yes. Chris Hedges, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. I hope that people will get your book, Unspeakable. I wish you a good, successful new year. I wish all of us that. And we'll get you back on here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The new book, Absolute Madness, details the true story of a serial killer in New York whose targets were African-American males. A young white Joseph Christopher struck fear into the residents of Buffalo and New York City in the 1980s. This former Army private, who was dubbed both the .22 caliber killer and the Midtown slasher, murdered at least 17 men in a four-month spree across the state. Christopher, who suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, had tried to admit himself to the Buffalo Psychiatric Center in September 1980, but was told that he wasn't a danger to himself or others. 2 weeks later, the killings began. Noted FBI profiler John Douglas assisted in the investigation that drew national attention and criticism from Jesse Jackson and other civil rights leaders. When the killer was finally found, he seemed on the surface an unlikely person to have held New York City in such a grip of terror. We're joined today by the author of Absolute Madness, Catherine Pellinero. Catherine is a true crime author and commentator. Her earlier book, Kitty Genovese, A True Account of a Public Murder and Its Private Consequences, was a New York Times bestseller. She is a contributing writer for Investigation Discovery's Crime Feed and has appeared on episodes of A Crime to Remember and Fox Files, among others. She lives in Los Angeles, California. Catherine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
How did you come to be interested in the Joseph Christopher case?
Well, I grew up in Buffalo, New York. My father was a police officer there for more than 30 years. Now, he did not work on the Joseph Christopher case, but of course many of his friends and colleagues did. And I had finished the book Kitty Genovese in 2014. I had spent 7 years on that book, and I didn't have another project in mind. I was about to go to Buffalo and Western New York to do some publicity for Kitty Genovese, and one of my sisters suggested that I write the story of the .22 caliber killer. And I told her, well, I don't really remember that. I was living in the Buffalo area when the crimes were happening, but I was in grade school out in suburbia and, you know, just remember the headlines. And she encouraged me, and she said, well, you know, it's a really compelling story. There's never been a book about it. You know, you should really look into it. So while I was in Buffalo, I did. I spoke to a friend in the district attorney's office, and he said, well, you know, we have all the original case files if you are interested in writing something. So I decided to take a look, and once I got into it, I agreed with my sister that it was just an incredibly compelling and terribly tragic story, but it was also so very different from sort of how it had been portrayed in the media at the time. In other words, they had sort of portrayed this case as in Joseph Christopher was this racist who wanted to start a one-man race war. You know, they really gave no other information. That was sort of like the through line for the case. And then as I started looking into it, and I'm looking at the actual case files, the interviews from the district attorney's office and the police department, I'm finding all of these background interviews on Christopher. He had no criminal history, which that's not terribly unusual for a serial killer. But they had interviewed a number of Christopher's black friends, you know, black men who were close friends of Joseph Christopher, not just acquaintances. And they, every single one of them had told the police, no, you've got the wrong guy. Joe is a great friend of mine, known him for years. He's never shown any racial animosity. So that, of course, piqued my curiosity. I thought, well, you know, what's going on here? Who suddenly becomes a racist at the age of 25 and goes on a killing spree? And then as I looked into it, there was, of course, so much more to the story. It was, it became a story about a man who became horribly mentally ill and tried to seek help for his problems before any of these killings happened. And what really struck a chord with me was that, very sadly, we're still hearing stories today about people who develop, you know, mental problems, and they seek help for these problems, and they don't get it. I mean, as recently as this May, the man who ran his car into Times Square in New York City had sought help for mental illness, was turned away.
Catherine, we want to talk about that, but I want to first give listeners more of a sense of this case. Joseph Christopher committed his murder spree from September 1980, I believe, until his arrest in May 81. Now, how soon did it take New Yorkers, both in the city and upstate, to realize that his targets were, with I think one notable exception, African-American men?
Well, that realization came very quickly, because the first murder happened on September 22nd, 1980, and that was in Buffalo. And in the span of 3 days, there were 4 African-American men who were shot. And the police discovered right away they were shot. They were all shot with the same .22 caliber weapon, or, you know, ballistics tests showed that. And these 4 victims were completely different. They had no connections. I mean, they varied in age and profession. So it was very quickly apparent to the police that not only did they have a serial killer, but they had a serial killer who was randomly attacking black men on the street. And you have to remember, this was only 3 years after the Son of Sam case in New York City. So people were familiar with that type of ambush attack on the street. So right away, they knew that they had this situation. They had this serial killer who was targeting black men. And from the fleeting witness descriptions, they knew it was a white male. So that realization came very quickly. And then in New York City, a couple of months later, there were 6 African-American men attacked in a single day, December 22nd, 1980, with just in the span of a few hours, right in Midtown Manhattan, all in the same general vicinity. So, and the attacks just kept going on and on. So it became very quickly apparent that they had a racially motivated serial killer. And, of course, this caused a lot of not only fear, but tension, you know, racial tension in the city, because in Buffalo and to a lesser extent New York City, just because it's a much, much bigger. But there was, you know, the question was, is this an organized effort by a hate group? So there was a lot of fear and trepidation and suspicion, and it was a really, really terrible, terrible thing.
Catherine, I imagine that the fact that Christopher cut out the hearts of 2 of the victims really added to the fear at the time in terms of the violence.
Well, actually, Christopher didn't do that. He was not responsible for those 2 crimes. The reason people feared that he did, or that at the time the unknown serial killer was responsible, was because those 2 killings of the cab drivers happened 2 weeks after the shooting. So there was a fear there that the serial killer had upped his game, so to speak. But as it turns out, Joseph Christopher had nothing to do with those crimes. Those were entirely different. Those 2 victims were actually connected.
John Edward Douglas, the noted former special agent in the FBI, he was the unit chief, I think, he assisted in the case. He was one of the first criminal profilers and was featured in that excellent TV program, Mindhunter. What were his contributions to the case and finding the killer?
John Douglas was brought in very early on by officials in Buffalo, within the week after the killings of the 2 cab drivers. And John Douglas developed a profile of the killer, a very detailed profile. And, of course, this is based on, you know, his years of research, interviewing serial killers and studying crime scenes. And his, a good part of his profile is in the book, Absolute Madness. And in most respects, it was very accurate. I mean, he predicted the age correctly. He predicted that Joseph Christopher would have held a series of menial jobs, probably, you know, would not be married, or if he was, would have been divorced. In other words, had a hard time with maintaining relationships. And another key thing that Douglas's profile predicted, and was very accurate, was he mentioned something about there was a likelihood that this offender had been in the military, but if he had been in the military, he would have been discharged for psychiatric reasons. And interestingly enough, Christopher was captured because he was in the Army, had a psychotic break, and was in the psychiatric unit. So Douglas really did, you know, as far as his profile, he really did contribute, giving them an idea of the type of offender they were looking for.
Catherine, let's talk now about Christopher's mental health. As you've mentioned, friends were very surprised to learn that he was the killer. After the military experience, he tried to get himself committed. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yes. Joseph Christopher seemed to notice, as far as I can pinpoint it, maybe towards the end of 1978, that his mental state was declining. Now, he didn't know what was happening to him at the time, but he was obviously very frightened, and there were a couple of close friends and confidants that he talked to. In fact, his best friend, and he confided to him, you know, I in the summer of 1980, he says, something's wrong with me. I think I'm going crazy. And his friend suggested he get some, he see a doctor. But anyway, by September of 1980, and Christopher had also isolated himself in this time. You know, he really wasn't socializing with people. He was kind of staying away. And as he said later, as he became ill, he was, you know, afraid to go out of the house. So 6 days before the first murder of Glenn Dunn in Buffalo, Joseph Christopher went to the Buffalo Psychiatric Hospital and asked to be admitted. And they, after a rather brief interview, they turned him away. They said, you know, they suggested that he seek counseling. And unfortunately, we know what happened after that. The murder spree began.
Catherine, after this gripping book and your earlier work on Kitty Genovese, do you plan to do more true crime pieces, or could there a piece of fiction in the future? Because this is really a great read.
Thank you very much. I'm a true crime author. I can't see myself going to fiction. First of all, you know, the old expression, truth is stranger than fiction. I think if I had pitched Absolute Madness as fiction, it would have been rejected. They would have told me, well, this is way too, you know, far-fetched or melodramatic or something.
And certainly you've added a truly important contribution to history, pulling everything together and setting the record straight.
Thank you. Thank you very much. One thing that I have to say was very disheartening about writing Absolute Madness when I was writing about the, like, especially a lot of the racial tension and then the, you know, services or lack thereof for the mentally ill, is how little things have changed, really. And that might be the biggest tragedy of all, because the story was very timely in that sense. It's not like, well, we've come so far since then. Unfortunately, we really haven't on those fronts, and that is tragic.
Yes, and of course, every day we read news accounts about individuals who should be in treatment, but for many reasons that characterize modern life are not, and the tragic consequences. Catherine, if people, in addition to getting Absolute Madness, which we truly recommend by Catherine Pellinero, can people learn more about you? Do you have a website?
Yes, my website is, it's my name, it's www.catherinepellinero.net. I have the website, and I welcome people to go to the website. They can contact me through there. I also have an author Facebook page. And I'm always happy to answer questions and engage with readers. I love hearing from readers.
Great. Well, we are really thankful to have heard from you today, and keep up your important work.
Well, thank you very much. I'm honored to be a guest on your show, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine. You take it easy.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.